Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe and I am a dragon. And my guest this week is a dragon as well, which means it ain't our year, because it's the Chinese New Year of the monkey, just started a couple of days ago, and it provided the perfect excuse for us to do something we should have done long ago, which is head to the heart of the West End, to Chinatown. Have your red pockets at the ready.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
Well, hello, hello. I am seated at a table in a Chinese restaurant in Chinatown. All that's missing really is the food. We have everything else we could possibly want, including a cultural ambassador for Chinatown, Jeff Leong. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
I gather food is on the way.
Yes, indeed. Food is always on the way. And it is always a waiting process. You're never content until your tummy is full of delicious Chinese.
We are in Chinatown. Will not have escaped your attention, listener, that there are things afoot in Chinatown at the moment. There's change of several different sorts. We'll come to that in just a second, actually, but for anyone who is familiar with London, even for those outside of London, it would probably be useful to get a sense of the scope of Chinatown.
Well, this is incredible. It's pretty much, you could say, the largest Chinatown outside China, and I've always referenced it now as the European gateway to the east, to the Far East. Over the years, a lot of people misunderstand Chinatown, but it's one of the most incredible experiences coming through. I recall pushing my daughter, who was 4 years old at the time, pushing through the streets of Jarrah Street, and she looked around and go, wow, it's all these other Chinese people. And she realized that, actually, Daddy is not the only Chinese person in West End. And it's incredible. You have now sandwiched in between the heart of West End. A lot of people remember there's a Chinatown there. But whatever you remember Chinatown in your history of 5-10 years ago, it's no longer what it is. Chinatown has completely changed.
And what's your involvement in all of this? Why are you a cultural ambassador?
Well, I've always loved supporting the arts, whether it's the fashion, film, industry, and a lot of different things. For example, it started this journey about 4 years ago when I've known many various artists in London, whether they are emerging artists to very established and successful YBA artists. And I realised that Chinatown, they because of the pedestrianisation during the festival, which is happening again this weekend on the 14th, how incredible there's no cars, no traffic. So I thought, hold on a second, then there's opportunity to do something. And this is really incredible space, which is the Chinatown car park, Q Park, which we turned into a one-day art exhibition for hundreds of international artists. And I call out to them, say, this is a space to use. It's not being utilized because the streets are close to cars. And let's do something. And this is just one of the many culture activities I do. But it's also important to understand the journey of myself as being Chinese from Hong Kong. Lots of people see us as, oh, you look Chinese, yeah, we're different. And also, what we eat are very different. And that becomes an interesting talking point. So let's start from the journey. So for some of our family founded the Zen restaurants, for those who are based in London, remember they were in the prime areas of Hampstead, Chelsea, Mayfair. It's very much the minimalism of the then Rick Mather, the architect who designed this very, very glamorous fine dining scene. And of course then, every one of you, probably most of the listener that eats Chinese, have pretty much realised Chinese from one region alone. That is pretty much Canton or Hong Kong, because this is the time before China opened up. And now China's opened it. It's not because China was closed off. It's because all those from Hong Kong came over here, many of them from southern China, from Canton, and you're eating Cantonese food. So the simple.
So this is the stuff that we'd be getting in little provincial towns in the 70s and 80s. This is Cantonese.
Yeah, so Cantonese has always been the main thrust of the Chinese cuisine. So when you're looking at the crispy duck, the incredible dim sum, which is now very, very popular, all the way through to a lot of the quick fry, fresh wok fry, to the sea bass, a steamed sea bass with a touch of ginger, garlic, and a dash of soya. But what was incredible is China's changed, because China's opened up, and China is the size of Europe. And you don't expect European countries all serve the same food. Likewise, because China now represents so many different regions, so many different, in terms of ethnic interest, you have the Uzbek from part of the Western Front to the Dongbei to the Northeast. These are all different parts of China, all have their own traditions going back 4,000 years. And now, when people come over from their region to London, they go, I eat my own home cooking, and this is Cantonese food. What is it?
Well, no, that's interesting, the European comparison, because within Europe, we've got a very specific idea of what French food represents, as distinct from probably what British food represents. Very different stories. Within China, I would imagine that there is a view of what Cantonese food might represent, but within the London Chinese community, with Cantonese food having been out there for this long, how is it regarded? Is it passé and boring?
Well, I think probably 10 years ago, a lot of people probably got bored and got tired of a lot of genre of Chinese cuisine, meaning to Cantonese food. And I don't necessarily blame those who don't understand Chinese food. Is that that's what you've been introduced. And I think when people go and eat Chinese food, it's not, oh, you go there open mind. You go to a European restaurant thinking, what shall I eat? Let's look at the menu. And you have these dishes. But for Chinese cuisine, what draws you to go to Chinese cuisine, I've always explained, is, oh, you miss eating crispy duck and that sweet and sour pork dish. Isn't because that was something that was very exotic at the time. It was that is what you recognize as Chinese cuisine. So when people invite you out for Chinese or introduce you, remember the listeners who have eaten their first Chinese meal, that's what you eat. So therefore, when you think of eating Chinese, it's not thinking eating Chinese as a category. Those dishes that you go, oh, I miss my har gao siu mai dumplings. Let's go and eat har gao siu mai. And where can I eat that har gao siu mai? And of course, thanks to a lot of friends from whether it's Anyao and others that I've met along the journey, there's a lot of traditional dishes. And there's a huge amount of new experimental, you could say it's not necessarily fusion in a sense, but new recipes being used. Like here, sitting in Dumpling Legend, you have Xiaolongbao, the soup dumplings. It's been around for centuries. But then you also have these incredible dumplings like sea bass and fennel, and you have truffle and prawn dumplings. What, they're not, you could say, uniquely Chinese, but it's also the whole idea of Marco Polo coming in. And I think this ideas is a very incredible relationship we have, and how fun it is to live and work in London. And of course, last time I think I had lunch with Mark Hicks, and of course, being an old friend, I said, Mark, you love your dumplings. I said, I remember as a child going to boarding school and looking forward to this dumpling on a menu, go, wow, there's dumplings on the menu in school food, and came out a lump of dough. I go, my God. And then Mark said, oh, let's do a dumpling together. I said, what would you like to do? So he said, well, black pudding in a Xiaolongbao. I said, that's an interesting idea. And that became a story, and we thought, let's experiment, let's taste it. But this is what's incredible about food. It's down to what you understand as Chinese cuisine, and going in with open mind and go, right, Chinatown's different now. There's so many different dishes to eat. You can go to a lot of sites and have fabulous time, but you have to go just like the way you go to a European restaurant and order something exotic and open mind, eat and enjoy.
I'm going to have to wrestle the subject off food, because otherwise I'm going to start eating the microphone. There are plenty of other facets to Chinese culture, of course, in Chinatown and spreading out from Chinatown. What would you look at as good examples of maybe London-centric Chinese influence?
Well, certainly, I think when you walk through Chinatown, well, I always say to friends who live around West End, or even going to see a theatre, looking, just walking along Shaftesbury Avenue, just look like another very typical Georgian Britain street. But when you go through Gerrard Street or Lyle Street, you have a real sense that you've emerged into somewhere like the Far East for the day. And a lot of people don't kind of realise, what do you mean? Well, the smells, you see the street market full of stores showing their lovely vegetables that you don't necessarily see. I mean, how many of us know what jackfruit and durian looks like? And you don't
What do they look like?
Well, they're like very spiky, massive, huge melons that have massive spikes. And there's so many exotic vegetables, and I think London's changed. People now understand Asia more because everyone now do business with China. And so if you go to China for business, you have to know a thing or two about the culture. And I think going through and looking at, for example, the other day I was walking down Wardour Street and seeing this fabulous new gate, almost like a huge totem telling the world you have arrived in Chinatown.
Yes, what's this new gate all about? Can you describe it for us?
Well, gate is always something very prosperous and it's all meaning of luck and it's a great way to engage the community at large. The more importantly is to earmark the London community and the tourism community that London Chinatown is right here. And that's what's important about London Chinatown. I mean, you're looking at this incredible street full of incredible Chinese diverse of businesses, and there's plenty of law firm, there's hairdressers, there are lots of cake shops, and plenty of fresh sea, in terms of fresh markets selling seafood. I mean, just on the back of Dancy Place, a lot of people don't know this little alleyway. And there's fishmongers selling fresh sea bass, fresh razor scallop, fresh lobster in massive tanks. And you're in West End thinking, where can I buy these things? And you wander into your local supermarket, and all they have is all frozen and refrigerated goods. And you don't even know there's a place you can buy fresh produce in the heart of Chinatown.
Well, that does surprise me, because my first impressions were that the supermarkets here contain a lot of dried and tinned stuff that have probably been exported and spent a long time on a container ship.
Yes, indeed. And then I think certainly there's the whole balance of keeping things lasting long, and hydrated food is always very popular in Asia. And it's kind of the story I said about Sichuan cuisine, where there's all these spicy Sichuan dishes come from. And, well, all this dry chili came from South America during the Silk Road. And of course, the journey of the Western culture, Central China, landlocked regions, they embossed the food and a lot of flavours. And for example, here in Dumpling Legend, you could taste this Sichuan sea bass broth, which is a Sichuan broth. And it's a very classic dish.
You're talking about delicious food again.
Well, yes, indeed. Because I think a lot of people have to look at Chinatown with the context of food. But I look at it very importantly as the economic wider remit. I mean, of course, talking about economy and China is very important. But just look at Chinatown. Chinatown, you're looking at, in terms of a few street alone, on average site, a large premises, probably contribute £400,000 a year in business rates. You're looking at streets alone, £40-50 million contribute to central government, which is an incredible benefit. And what's really important is now Chinatown is a tourism area and brings such a huge importance to the capital.
There's another part of London that's got a connection with Chinese history, which is over in the East End in the Docks, Limehouse. Does that figure in the Chinese historical consciousness here? Do people here still connect with that area in any way, or is that long gone?
Well, yes, I think certainly many of those who hear and listen to the illicit wars in Far East Asia and the whole aspect of the illegal treaties, and those who do a bit of research in opium wars, an incredible, colourful journey of both the up and down relationship that Britain had with China. But this is a long, long time ago.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it.
But that's a really long time ago. But of course, what's really interesting is that I've definitely heard a lot of stories about the incredible opium dens and opium. In terms of what it was, as a symbol of trade. And it's almost a very, you could say, a powerful symbol. Everyone knows there's this drug that exists as a form as opium. But it's also a reference to the negative connotation of those who just, in terms of chilling out all day and not necessarily doing work. And in a way, conjure up how these dens that used to exist in the east of London, when they were actually, back then, these workers who were looking for a greener grass to come to England, jumping ship, decide not to work on the boats anymore, and decide to be here in London making a trade. And they realised that there was population of Britain who were addicted to stuff. So it wasn't the workers that were perhaps themselves enjoying it, because they're very hard at work. They're non-stop on the docks loading up the goods. And it's actually, I think some of them saw it as a business opportunity. And I think, like with many of these illicit underground business that goes on for hundreds of years, how that has changed that area of East London. And it's an incredible impact to see now, looking at the docks, looking at the surrounding space. Wow, what memories of Chinatown that remains. And I remember a while back seeing some of the roads, some of the spaces. There is no Chinatown. It's so sad. Why couldn't there be more than just one Chinatown?
Well, I was really wondering about that because, for example, and it's one example among many, if you talk to somebody who's interested in the Jewish history of London, a lot of the Jewish population started out in the East End and gradually migrated to the north of town. But there's still plenty of fond and not so fond memories of that part of town, and people go back and nostalgise over the buildings there and where people used to be. Is there still that connection?
I think that a lot of the generation I spoke to, because Chinatown goes through a lot of different phases, it's very rare that you now probably see any generation that remain from that part of the docks who lived through the years, and now they're the generation, maybe 3-4 generation, that their family used to be in docks. I think certainly probably do exist, and I've heard many of our stories, and I think almost like referencing the Jewish community, how many of them, the ethnic community that you see, the Chinese really does stand out because they look very different. They probably remember back in the early 18th century, they all had huge long plaits that's down to the waist, and they still live a very traditional lifestyle. And I do remember many of these references of many of these Chinese etiquette. You have to remember, it's culturally very, very different. It's not the way that we as humanity look at everyone around us who've lived through thousands of years of struggle. And here we are when you're looking at that culture. And it's the way that I remember one of the interesting stories that our friends have told me is how, for example, the Jewish community, they don't celebrate Christmas and they all look forward to Chinese New Year because it's a time when they can all go out and eat great Chinese food and celebrate as their part of celebration. And you speak to many of the ethnic Jews, whether they're living in America, New York, a lot of that celebration of both the Chinese and many of the ethnic communities continue.
Thinking about difference for a moment, because goodness knows we as a species like to distinguish ourselves from anybody who's even slightly dissimilar to us. What's been the experience of integration of the Chinese community and the other London communities?
Well, I think, what's really true to what you've mentioned is how there's this different level of the Chinese that came over, and certainly you mentioned the docks, those who came, struggled, and tried to make a living. And you're looking back in the pre-war, post-war period when it's open door policies. Anyone can come in and out of Britain, you stay a few years, and you get to have the permanent residence. And of course, now many of our generation, for example, what was important is London or England as a whole is a great place for education. So many of the generation, you're looking at the leaders of China, the most successful, the businesses, whether they're politicians or businessmen, who can afford to send their kids into education system here, are the top 5% of China are sending their children. And they're bringing themselves their way of how and way they lived in China. And this is very much the new generation that is added on top of our generation. Many of my generation of friends now have kids and family, young children, came at a time when, of course, we were all kids sent to boarding school. And I was the only Chinese in my boarding school. Heath Mount, of course, in rugby, there was quite a few because one of the governors used to be a Hong Kong governor from rugby. So that's a great public relations for the school. And I was the only Chinese. I recall how difficult it was for me to try to live with everyone because I couldn't speak a word of English. And of course, now I've learned a few words. But how difficult it was to try to communicate your culture, your differences. And there's always a lot of stigma. There's always a lot of integration. But
How old are you?
10, yes, I was 10.
But how old are you now?
Well, I'm about, you could say, I'm a year of the dragon. So for listeners who are work out, I'm kind of the under the 40 year of the dragon.
That's not such a very long time ago that lack of understanding was going on.
Well, it is. And I think if you look at those who are from Hong Kong, and you have to remember Hong Kong that I came from was a very British Hong Kong. It wasn't the Chinese China Hong Kong you look at now, where the mainstream of the Chinese who go to London, the mainstream of the Chinese who are shopping there or retail in Hong Kong, that is what is interest to those who look at the business or commerce or tourism. And the fact that our generation, being Hong Kong British, we have a very westernized values. And those who are coming from China has a very eastern value, a very different value. And I think this is exactly what people look at, the dynamics. But I always jokingly said to friends, look how important China is for the papers. They said it's 70% of the world economy. And I always jokingly said, well, think about all the consumers from China, and thanks to all their consumerism, it's actually Communist China supporting free press? Well, true, because all these adverts from all these luxury brands rely on the spending from the consumers in China to support the publication in Western Europe. And it's an interesting dynamics. We know China is spending a lot supporting luxury goods, luxury value. And I'll tell the friends, why is there this obsession? And I tell them this story of, because what Hong Kong and Chinese went through, you're looking back in the 18th century in Hong Kong, when the Chinese were treated just as bad as, of course, terrible, they're bad as dogs, and then there's that really, yes, we know a lot of period of colonialism that China went through, and especially Hong Kong. It's the West, it's the British that ran Hong Kong with the Scottish, and they did a very successful, really good job. And so many of the Chinese trying to difference themselves, would, if they become successful, they would dress themselves looking very Western, buy Western cars, Western brands, to make themselves look upon that, look at me, I too are very successful, and I too am worthy to do business with. And that has become ingrained in a society that you go to Hong Kong, no one wears shorts out in Hong Kong, because they all want to look their best attire. And it's become part of the way that people perceive perception of dress well, and that triggered on to what I call this whole aspect of the luxury consumerism of wanting to dress well. And now the Chinese who are successful, they're not going to go, let's start on the middle brands and go up. They want to fast track to the best. Everything they want now is what's perceived as the best. And that's what's really interesting.
So there's that sense of keen aspiration. But what else? And if ever there were a doomed question, this is it. Because I'm about to ask a cultural ambassador this question. And it is, when I look at, for example, Brits abroad in the various places where British people go to live, perhaps in their retirement, you might think of Spain, for example, you get a sense not only of the British values as they should be and as we like to think of ourselves, but also the fact of what we actually are probably in those places and how we behave and the actual values that we export. So I'm going to ask you, what are the Chinese values, what are the Eastern values that Chinese people are actually bringing here?
Well, the incredible aspect is you see China, what it's gone through a lot.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
30, 40 years, they pulled over 600 million people out of poverty. It's an incredible achievement. And when you look at other emerging countries, what have they achieved? And of course, without pointing too many fingers, if China can do what they've done, there's no reason why other countries couldn't really have improved.
Okay, but what is the value that you see that has achieved that in the national mindset?
Well, it's the sheer aspect of everybody is so tied down to do what they've been told to do in terms of enjoying their work. They study so hard, they wanted to progress, they wanted to achieve education. And just, for example, university in China, there's 10 million applicants a year for university places, and there's only 7 million places a year. And the amount of incredible shifting through the those who are coming out of China now, very westernized values, not those who are coming over here and study, but they carrying with them the understanding that, yes, China is an incredible country. They've changed so much since the 40s, since the 50s. And what they're looking at is learning from all the West, learning a lot of things that we all kind of, in terms of being tried and tested. And now, if you said, what is the whole issues surrounding the success of Chinese? Is because if you look at China, what's incredible since the reform back in the 60s and 70s is everything is still state-owned. So if you think about the recent issue about steel, for example, why a lot of British firms have been affected. But if you look at China, that steel rod that comes out, the energy they use are state-subsidized. The iron ore is state-subsidized. The water is state-subsidized. But if you're looking at Western values of privatization, for us to go, well, before that even comes out of the factory, everyone who's supplying the energy, the water, the resource to the factory making the steel have already for profit. And we understand we live in a very capitalist, very pro-success, and the aspect of it is everyone is trying to make the best for their business. And China have somehow managed to become the manufacturer of the world because it's the sheer value of how they can make things at good price. But then I think this is the interesting debate on minimum wage, because for what you get in China, you can go to Starbucks for £4 and have your cappuccino in China. But then for the same £4, you can have a feast for a family of four in the next door restaurant that's cooked by local, because they too have very standard livings. You don't have to feel that you only earn so much per hour and that's how much you get. And you look upon this service to go, wow, there's people who are being paid very little for what they do. But that money stretched a long way in China.
So I've got a sense of, at the moment, China as this great big engine that's rumbling and getting ever faster and moving up a gear, perhaps. What about, rather than achievement in this somewhat material sense, I guess we've been talking about it, and maybe we're edging into the cultural side of things, but particularly with cuisine, but what about the soul of China and the soul of Chinatown? Where do we find that?
Well, the soul of Chinatown is incredible. It's a pure Chinese identity. And for those who don't understand what is it like, not regionally, but about you being Chinese, it's almost, I guess, talking to friends, say, are you Welsh? Are you Scottish? Are you Irish? You're English? Are you Great Britain? Are you United Kingdom?
Yes, give me some of that. What does it mean to be Chinese?
Exactly. What does it mean to be Chinese? Being Chinese is almost, I think I've gone through this incredible journey of as a youth, Chinese under the British. I feel very westernized. I love the Western, and you enjoy everything. You enjoy how the, you know, whether it's a kid drinking milkshake, how the fast food industry, and then later on to the stage whereby now suddenly there's so much more interest about China. People are fascinated about China, and then Hong Kong is this small island, and started doing trade with China and become bigger and bigger, and now more and more people reference China. But you're looking at a place where there's a billion people. You look at London, England, there's 60 million people. I mean, it's a very vast volume of people. And you can't get to know everybody. And that is the truth. And one of the interesting thing of the Chinese identity is, yes, we kind of have a lot of the traditions that you say a lot of the British, a lot of the Western don't understand. And what is it that's truly to be Chinese? Is it the family union that you always look after and respect the elders? You always really care for your family and care for others. And there's a lot of value that in your heart that, as I recall being Chinese, is how we try to, in terms of looking after many of the family units and being very, very caring, and the thought process that goes into that aspect of family union. And is, you could, you know, we talk about food. And every Chinese festival, whether it's Chinese New Year, Lantern Festival, special day to celebration, you have to get your whole family out. I mean, it's very sad. My parents always said to me, you know, Jeffrey, one day when we pass away, remember to call your brother, call your sister, call your uncles, get everybody together. You have to look after that. It's almost like the ancestors of Confucius still ancestor worship them 46 generations later. I could have got it wrong, but it's incredible. There's this love of the family unit, and you think about all those who's passed away, and it's this culture that you think you're not just here for the moment. You've been here and thanks to all your families before you. And that's one thing that I've always very sentimental about. And I think me as personally, looking around, we always forget that, wow, look around us. All these people for us to have as humanity survived world wars, plague, Black Death, and for us to be here today, we kind of forget that, wow, many of our forefathers have worked so hard. If they weren't successful or if they were ill, they would have died out that generation a long time ago. And to look around, whether that's the homeless person on the street, whether that's someone that's achieved and got a sense of place, they too have gone through just because of the immediate circumstances.
So thinking about then that sense of belonging to the past, or being so closely connected and respectful of past in the family sense, does that make things challenging for somebody who is first or second or maybe even third generation here in England? Do you feel like you're isolated? What are the tensions?
Yes, indeed. Many of the Chinese have an incredible story to their home. And even though you look at my family immediate circumstances, both my grandmother, the family, they're all in the actresses and in the film business, and they were all very looked upon. And my grandfather was the only son who had a lot of inheritance from what their business were. And back in that period, when you look back, I remember as a children, my grandfather had this huge house in where this Repulse Bay Road and a house in Kennedy Road, and have a lot of servants and helpers. But whatever they was, the family was always the head of the unit, and the grandmother were the boss. Everybody has to get approval, and it's almost that story I've said is what everyone needs to seek approval. If you give your maid a red pocket money of, you know, give her some tips, say buy some sweets, the maid would go to her boss and say, Madame boss, uncle, fifth uncle, like the fifth youngest, or fifth, gave me an envelope of £50 as a gift. Can I accept that? Everyone needs to seek approval, even to the point that when I wanted to marry my wife, and even a few of my uncles who already married Western kind of families, and they were asking approval. And I said to my grandma, I want to marry my wife. She's a doctor, and I'd like to marry her. And my grandma was saying, yes, wish you all the happiness, but I would disinherit you. And I literally have to have
what?
And I literally have to three meetings to appoint to have a talk one to one. And what's incredible, this journey that I do share with my friends, is what this story of disinheritance. And it was only when I met my grandma and said to her, Grandma, my uncles, you know, of course, they all got married Westerners, and my grandma bought them houses, whether it's in Chelsea and others' place. I said, why do you want to disinherit me? And I said, well, it's because my grandma was worried about one thing. I said, what is that you're worried? She was worried that I would be humiliated. And I remember looking through, no matter how successful they were, all these pictures of the balls they went to, when they were young, there was no Western face in the parties they go to, in the balls they go to, in the newspaper they read. It's a very divided society back then. Even the most wealthiest and most successful, they are isolated in their group of in their profile. It's the same as when I meet many of the successful British families down in Hong Kong. You wouldn't see Chinese in their imagery, the friends. You see them socially. And I kind of ask her why you felt I would be humiliated, because that concept did not exist. I went to boarding school. I understand there are kids who are a bit racist, and a few kids who say a bit, you know, saying to me, even my good friends for 30 years, I remember him teasing me, Jeff, you got jaundice. And I go, what is jaundice? I have no idea what jaundice is. But obviously, you know, there's a bit of wittiness, there's a bit of joke. And I realise it's because that period, they felt so much repression that the Chinese weren't allowed to do what they wanted to do. And that probably ingrained into them. Now, I kind of felt that certainly the cultural identity of those who live in Hong Kong, you have that really interesting link between those who keep the Chinese tradition, but yet they want to have short hair. And how my grandfather, when he was young, he had short hair and glasses, when everyone still had plaits and the old, whether it's the Lady Wang Chansam, the traditional costume, or the long kind of Chinese dress, there was this whole westernization that really happened. And if you look at China happened so much quicker. It wasn't that 1 minute you could say everyone was wearing very simple. And if you look back, wow, how come we just all miss China? How did it all change so quickly? Suddenly, you look at Beijing in the 80s, all bicycle, and now it's all cars. And it's not just cars from China. It's not like looking at Russia when it's all Ladas. You're looking at China now, it's all the European cars. They all aspire to buy Western goods and Western design. And kind of going back to the question I say. But then This whole story of then, we are now in this environment whereby those who have it or haven't got it, you have an incredible kind of the pull push. We know all the Chinese that are here, every Chinese here, who are in boarding school, who are in school today, they are indeed from the top, you could say the top 5, top 3% of those who manage to send their kids overseas. Because we all know it's not cheap to send your school kids into private education. But it's because the Chinese believe the value. If you said they're very, very much in terms of the belief, why are they sending the kids? Because they want to give them the best opportunity. They want to give them the best education. And just look at that. Don't think that the British haven't got good education, because the Chinese know what they think is good. And they are sending their kids here. So it's an incredible achievement for Britain to feel they are teaching the next generation, whether you're English, whether you're Chinese, whether you're Japanese. There's this incredible thought process that goes through in the British education system that really helps to free up your mental block, to allow you to think for yourself. And for myself, that's what I can speak on behalf of what my journey has been through.
And it is an amazing journey. And when one thinks about how politically a comparable journey might have worked for somebody in Soviet Union or some of the countries in Eastern Europe that were governed as part of that union, and then the wall came down and suddenly capitalism came rushing in for good or ill, and you speak to some of those people, particularly people who lived through that and can remember it clearly, and some of them still hanker after the days of communism.
I've always commented on, well, yes, after the Berlin War, and the Americans and British go, the Russians have taken stuff off the Germans and so it's theirs now. And I go, hold on a second, all these Eastern European blocs, Romania, all these great countries had their own incredible culture, the kingdom. And the Russians came and took it off. The Cold War happened. No one wanted to make a big scene. And they said, we just took it off all the Germans and it's theirs now. But we all know that is wrong or right is the history book to in terms of diverge more into. But what China went through was incredible. I always jokingly said is maybe one day I will win my Nobel Peace Prize by unifying China and Taiwan back to Hong Kong. Because I was joking, he said, well, Hong Kong was given by the Qing Dynasty for 99 years for the Hong Kong Island. But of course, it's the unequal treaties. But then after 99 years, who should it go back to? Hold on a second, where's Qing Dynasty? But then you can start going to, well, after Qing Dynasty, does it go to the nationalists in Taiwan? Or who does it go to? But it's incredible in terms of looking at how China has changed. China went through, I think what many people kind of forgot is, now we look at the incredible arts and craft from China, the porcelain, these beautiful artisans. During the 1850s, when the world were obsessed with building dreadnoughts and gunships, China said, we had enough of wars. Let's just build beautiful palaces and talk poetry. And they did not invest in arms. And it became a weak nation. They focused on culture, they focused on what they enjoyed. And I think certainly every country goes through this incredible journey. But what we remember to China then was now people are much more appreciative of the past. And it's very true that they do, in a sense, realise that, wow, China has an incredible depth, an incredible history. And the Chinese themselves are trying to learn as much of that history as they can. But it's not easy. 4,000 years of history. I mean, you only got 365 days in one calendar to celebrate. How could you celebrate every single important features of Chinese culture?
Well, a way into it, of course, would be to name some names. And, of course, anyone will have come across one Chinese artist. And I think he's the Chinese artist that everybody knows. He might be the only Chinese artist that everybody knows. So this is a great opportunity to name some other names. Who should we be looking at?
Well, I think the Chinese, in terms of many of the interesting people to look at, I mean, there's Liang Zhufu and many of the incredible aspects of what you said, the artist community. Now, the interest between arts and China has really become one of the process of what people love to talk about. And I think certainly there's so many incredible artists that have lived and breathed, and there are a lot of different parties of people who have their vested interest in supporting artists. And I always try to reference this because you'll realise that the journey of supporting art, supporting what people have their beliefs, has always been an incredible process. And artists have for many years have allowed the opportunity to express their views. And you can see some are more, you can see is it the buzzword of the political aspect of using that issue surrounding them. I mean, if you said how funny is that if there was an artist that was locked up in Guantanamo Bay and coming out in the orange jumpsuit, if you made a piece of work out of it, would people go, oh, that is really interesting? We know there's been a lot of problems, and I think the Western world, both the Eastern world, have owned up to a lot of issues, and they are trying to resolve some of the ways we're trying to combat many of the topics of choice. And art is an incredible platform to talk and elaborate. And I remember many of the interest at how, for example, you're looking at the incredible institution in this country. One thing that we all forget is how looking at artists. And one thing I really enjoy about the artist community is how generous artists are. And I remember meeting friends like Gavin Turk and talking to people like Trace M, and how if you're looking at how much works they donate to charities as a pure gift that enables people to give, to auction charity, to help raise money for charity. A lot of people forget that it's an incredible asset that they bring to help many others. And in a way, we need to kind of remove ourselves to look at art as a piece of work that think, oh, it's a very expensive piece of work as a contemporary artist. Is it about the value you want, or do you love that subject matter? What does it engage with you? And you know, we aren't shy to look at, if you're looking at, you know, of course, the Royal Academy, how incredible is supporting the art. And if you're just looking at the Art Huawei exhibition, what's incredible is that there was not one corporate sponsor wanted to sponsor it. And you look back the image, oh yes, there's no one image. It's because some people don't want to upset people. And not upsetting people, it might be just a safer, it's almost like sitting on the bench. And I think certainly this is not about relationship we all have. Everyone have relationship, but you know, it's important to realize that relationship is a very cultural dynamic. We're all sharing our understanding. We all should be entitled to our views to express what we have problems with. We challenge politicians. We challenge people about problems, and we all do this as a process. And certainly, if you said yes, who's the brave ones? It aren't the Chinese artists who are holding the English or American passport. The brave ones are, you could say, the ones that are holding the Chinese passport and go, well, yes, they have no, in terms of, you know, they are really voicing their concern. But it's important to understand that art has become an important part of the facade because it influenced so much of our culture. What you talk about, the Chinese ceramics, the Chinese calligraphy, the Chinese painting, things that creeped into our culture, even our language, the Chinese language, where did that come from? It wasn't invented by computer. These are all picturesque. These are all part of the culture that we can fast forward 4,000 years. We are now today. But thanks to what? Thanks to all this incredible achievement. Both the Britain made, both what the British made back in the last 400 years of trading with China. If it's not for that journey, you could say China could be a very different place. What if Hong Kong wasn't involved, if the British never went out there, what would China be now? I mean, it could be just incredible if you just think of it that way.
Which, if I had any good sense about me, would be where I would end this podcast, because it was such a big statement and a big idea. But like a fool, I've got one tiny, very specific question to ask, which is with the Chinese New Year in the air. You mentioned red pockets earlier on, and for somebody who's not familiar with that, what is a red pocket, a red envelope?
Yes, I think certainly Chinese New Year is all about prosperity. It's almost, I guess, the Western way of the Chinese New Year countdown. Yeah, have a great Happy New Year, to health. And the Chinese say, yeah, it's to health, but also to wealth. They want wealth and health. They want actually everything. And I think this is, in a way, I could say, it's a bit shameful and a bit crass to think about money, money, money. And this is what is tradition, is almost as a gift. So anyone that are married, they would have a red envelope. And in fact, just like today you mentioned it, I've got my red envelope to give to anyone.
You've got a pocket full of red envelopes.
So, Kung Fa Choi, so if you're not married and you're single, then you say Gong Hei Fa Choi to a married Chinese couple. And then they'll go, here you go, here's a red envelope. And inside the red envelope is, of course, is a money as to symbolise I'm passing my wealth from me to you. So my luck to you. And it's a great symbol gesture. And obviously it's something that a lot of people don't appreciate. Why would you just give out money? Because sometimes it's a thought that counts. I prefer the present. I don't want you to give a £10 note in a Chinese red envelope. So it's an incredible story to get that red envelope, giving your wealth to someone.
And it looks like an expensive business. That's all we have got time for. We've reached the end of our time here. From dumpling legend Jeff Leong, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
My heart aches for some far off place. No one could have left you with your name, how you raised us. Love's fate can be free from chains.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.